got up early this morning so I could walk the floor. I got to hit the streets 'cause there's a wolf outside my door. The bill collector's calling and my kids need better shoes. Gonna go to church on Sunday 'cause I got nothing left to lose. And it's a good day. Good day for the blues. It's raining cats and dogs outside, and I'm looking for a job. The man I work for laid me off. It's a good day. It's a real good day for the blues.
That's Ruth Brown belting it out at the age, I think she was about 70 years old at the time. A Good Day for the Blues, the title track of her 1999 album. Ruth Brown was a singer, a songwriter, instrumentalist. She played piano and keyboards, and she also was an actress. She was called the Queen of R&B. She was also a Tony and Grammy Award winner because of her stunning performances on Broadway, which I was privileged to see. And she also was an activist. In her field, in her industry, she played a major role in helping musicians secure their rights for royalties and contracts. She died on November the 17th, 2006, from complications of a heart attack and stroke that she suffered, and she was 78 years old, Ruth Brown. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Thursday, October the 9th. And we hear a familiar story coming out of St. Louis, 16 miles from Ferguson. Same troubling story. And the information is still murky and is going to become more and more clear, one hopes, as the day passes on. But, you know, this is so ironic because just yesterday, the program was about the second month that had passed since the killing, the police killing, of Michael Brown in Ferguson, 16 miles away from where this killing occurred last night in the Shaw neighborhood of Missouri. And the reason that that came to mind to do as a program yesterday was, as you know, I've been following these things, and I have a tendency, you know, when things are so wrong, you come back to it time and again because you want people to understand that although the media cameras have gone and the photographers have gone and all of the hoopla has died down, this is the reality. The reality is what's left behind when all of these high-profile things are done and carefully choreographed for, you know, lots of ink in the newspapers and lots of footage on television. The structural problems remain behind and invariably unsolved, and also invariably little justice delivered. So I tend to do this. I'd come back, as I have with Detroit, the city of Detroit, meaning that we pay attention to these things because they are telling us a story. They are a warning to the entire nation about the systematic, the subjugation of a particular group. And even if you think that, well, gee, that's not me, I'm not a member of that group, the fact is, as we see it unfolding all over the world, and certainly here in the United States, when you think it's not going to happen to you, eventually it will. And these are meant to be lessons for people to get involved and to say, this is not the society that we ought to be living in. This is not what it should be at all. So last night, according to reports, there was a police-involved killing of also an 18-year-old man in the predominantly African-American part of town known as Shaw in St. Louis. We still don't know what the facts are, but the preliminary reports are saying that the police officer who was at the time on an assignment as a security person working off duty. He was off duty at the time, working in some security capacity. We don't know yet, or it has not yet been said where he was working or what specifically his job was. But the police chief, Sam Dotson, did confirm that he was off duty. We still don't know the name of the officer. His name has not yet been disclosed. That he was, he came upon a group of four young men, and upon seeing him approach them, they scattered. And one of them appeared to be reaching into his waistband, and the officer, who is 32 years old, made sure, this is now the police chief talking, that he exercised good judgment in making or trying to be reasonably sure that that's what it was. And it turned out, according to the police chief, that the young man was reaching for a gun, which he aimed at the officer, fired off three shots before the officer responded by firing 17. A 9mm gun was located at the scene, according to police reports. And three spent shells, the gun and the spent shells, supposedly linked to the young man, who so far has been identified as Von Derek Myers, 18 years old, a high school student. Other reports are saying, and what witnesses are saying, that he was unarmed, the young man was unarmed, and in fact, he did not have a gun. He was holding, according to his cousin, he had a sandwich in his hand. We don't know what the actual facts are just yet. But it is typical in a situation like this, you will get all kinds of reports, and then it will take some time for things to settle down, and you get a sense of what really happened. So that is not yet the time. Things are still unfolding rather quickly. But what is distressing is, of course, we see the dynamic here, which is remarkably consistent with the dynamic across the country. The dynamic being the confrontation is usually between an African American or Latino male and a white police officer, male, on the force between 0 and 7 years. This officer apparently is reportedly on the force for 6 years. But it is generally the case. I did a story a long time ago in which I took a look at this and found that in the vast majority of cases in the city of New York, where police officers were involved in killings of civilians, they were on the force an average of 0 to 5 years. And if I could determine that, I'm sure some statistician, some actuarial expert has understood the same thing. And therefore, just that fact alone should inform police departments all over the nation as to who poses the greatest likelihood of threat to the department in terms of reckless action. It would be a white male officer on the force between 0 and 5 years. In this case, it is 0 to 7 years. And therefore, that again would inform a special attention given to this training this particular group, since they will account for the vast majority of police-involved killings and police brutality, which is to say police criminality will occur largely within this group. This is not rocket science. I could do it. Any expert could do it, and especially an expert in policing. So that's the dynamic we see consistent here. And also a troubling thing, and the papers reported it as if it were no big deal, but it immediately jumped out at me that this police officer came upon this group when he was in his off-duty capacity, working as a security person in some other for some other company, but just happened to be in uniform, police uniform. That is very odd. And although the police commissioner at the time, the police chief, I should say, of the city of St. Louis, is discussing this as, focusing on the confrontation, the question immediately that jumps out is, how is it that a police officer who is off duty, working in another capacity, unrelated to his job, still is wearing his uniform and still is exercising all of the so-called authorities attendant to a police officer in uniform, including the killing of a civilian? These are questions. So we have a lot of things now to consider. And so rather than come to conclusions, we'll wait and see what the facts turn out to be as they unfold, what we will learn as they unfold. But the media are not waiting, and the police are not waiting. They've already said, as is customary, but this is part of the thing that happens, that kicks in automatically. They already have said that the young man in question, Mr. Myers, Von Derrick Myers, was no stranger to the law. That is supposed to say to the public, don't be overly sympathetic. This was probably not a nice guy, and we shouldn't feel any particular sense of sympathy about this with respect to him. Nor, on the other side, we should feel rather sympathetic to the police officer. We've been conditioned, of course, to form an opinion based on this kind of information that is purposefully leaked out. We don't know the name of the officer, but somebody has taken the care to let us know that the young man, Von Derrick Myers, was no stranger to the law. And that's why, it jarred me, because I've been on this thing of looking at the systemic flaws here and what is happening in Ferguson and now 16 miles away, and there were other shootings in between these two, is that we see a community that is not dealing with the questions the way they ought to be dealt with. And I'm talking now specifically from the leadership end of things. When Michael Brown was killed, and it's awful to discuss it in this way, the fact that the lawyers for the family still to this day refused to involve themselves at a level that would signal an end to this assumption that these kinds of things, up to and including the killing of people by police, will have no real consequence to the actors involved. The people who were doing the work in Ferguson, the people who are really tending to the rights of the citizens of Ferguson from a legal perspective, there are no black lawyers involved in a public service way. There are no black preachers involved. There are no black elected officials involved in that capacity. They all are making, you know, statements at news conferences and so forth. And that's not going to solve the problem, is it? The ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, and I had the director of the legal affairs here talking with us on I think last week. That's who's doing the work. It is the ACLU that filed the first legal action in Ferguson to compel the city to divulge the name of the officer involved, Darren Wilson. Not the lawyers for even Michael Brown's family did that. This is fundamental work, and it signifies the degree of seriousness and commitment that people have to doing things that basically augment and support the call for justice. But they're not interested in justice. They're interested in money. A simple thing like that. The ACLU did it. It's the ACLU that compelled the courts to order the police of Ferguson to stop their encroachment on the rights and violating wholesale violation of the rights of people just trying to protest. It was the ACLU, not the NAACP, not the Urban League, not the National Bar Association, not the local group of black lawyers, not the local group of black preachers. It was the ACLU. It was the ACLU that went to court in behalf of young black men and Latino men who were taken off the streets of Ferguson and have been made to just disappear in the bowels of the jail system for protesting. And they're still there. Al Sharpton and Benjamin Crump, the lawyer for the family, and others who swooped into town with all of that la-di-da and tra-la-la around them, they've long since gone. It is the ACLU that is engaging in protecting the rights of these young people. They have stepped up to the plate. So when these people start flapping their lips and they start talking about the rights and rights, they're not prepared and they're not involved in the struggle for rights. They're just flapping their lips. And look at what a difference. I mean, you can only deal with this now post facto, unfortunately, because this incident has already resulted in another fatality. But had there been an appropriate response legally at the time of Michael Brown's killing, do you think police officers would just still say, well, it's business as usual. We can shoot to kill. We could do whatever it is we want to do. Do you think that the local prosecutor attorney would continue to violate the law and misuse the grand jury in Ferguson, pretending that he's after justice, when in fact he's trying to give immunity to the very officer that he ought to be prosecuting? You see what I mean? The failure, and we have to call it, the failure of these lawyers to see to just even a modicum of justice, to even take care of business in that fashion, directly is linked to this death last night. Because they failed to intercept, they failed to stop, they failed to provide some kind of a system of checks and balances in a local situation that clearly is out of control. That's the problem. The work is not being done. And that's why I come back to these discussions all the time, to let people understand. Never mind the big protests that they're staging. Never mind the big speech that they're making. They're not doing the work. And they intend not to do the work. They intend not to do it. Because it's too hard. It's very grungy work. It's very unsexy work. It's the kind of work that doesn't get you accolades. It doesn't get you invitations to the White House. It is the kind of work that requires you to go up against the system. But you have to have a kind of sincerity of purpose, wouldn't you? They don't have that. You'd have to have a sense of obligation to history, and they don't have that. You'd have to have a sense, a genuine sense about the plight of your people and the oppression that they are experiencing every single day. They don't have that. They have now joined the zero-sum group of America. I got mine, you go get yours. And in fact, what's yours is mine. That's where they are. So when anybody talks about what went wrong here, the record ought to reflect that the lawyers, the black lawyers, the black leadership, the black church have all failed and continue to fail because they don't have the guts, really, when it comes down to it, they don't have the guts to confront the system. They don't want to, and they don't have the guts to do it. It is much easier, and you get a lot more out of just holding news conferences and making it look like you really want change. But what is required to effect change, they're not interested in doing at all, because it just disturbs the path that they're on. And the path that they're on is all about them and their professional accomplishments and their accolades and their profile in the community. It's all about their status, not their people. And we ought to be real clear about that. And it gives me a good way to segue into part two about the pimping of the black church. We have this concept of souls to the polls. Yes, it sounds nice. You know, we like things that rhyme. You know. So we have souls to the polls. And souls to the polls, this effort to energize the religious community, the church community, to bring about some kind of connection between that and political realities that these people are experiencing, to exercise and flex their muscle in some degree, to influence the outcomes of things. All these noble ideals were expressed as the reason, the raison d'être of souls to the polls. But actually, souls to the polls did not come out of the black church. Souls to the polls is not the articulation of the aggregate sense of what needs to be done within the black church. Souls to the polls is simply a marketing tool by the Democratic Party, especially in 2008. Souls to the polls was manufactured by the same people who manufactured the president. They manufactured a way to have the president connect with the very important constituency that, in fact, it turned out to be the most important constituency in his political success. and that is black people, black voters. The church, therefore, became a part of a marketing system. It became a part of a merchandising effort. The customers or consumers, if you will, are in or connected to the churches. So let's go get the churches. To get the churches, you get the people who are shepherding the flock. You get the pastors. And they sign up because of all kinds of things. They, again, love status. They love the idea that they are fulfilling a heavenly mission, even as their people are living in hell. They're getting the satisfaction of feeling that they are continuing the line of struggle. And this carefully manufactured marketing effort, which is like no other effort that the Democratic Party has, it is about taking a group of consumers, and you have to look at it now in terms of marketing. These are consumers. And what marketing is all about is persuading consumers to put the product within the realm of their choice. Awareness, making the consumer aware of a product or service, and then persuading them that they ought to buy it. That's what it's all about. The product, of course, is Barack Obama. And they were really careful about that. They were really savvy in the way they did that. They didn't say the product was the Democratic Party. They said the product was the black guy. Vote for the black guy. You're black just like he is. He's black just like you are. So help a brother out. Vote for the brother. And it worked fantastically. Black people outperformed every single ethnic group in America in terms of voting, and certainly in terms of voting for the Democratic Party, because the brother, send the brother to the White House, souls to the polls. Oh my gosh, they inundated the polling sites. They flooded them. They overwhelmed them. People were wondering, where were all these black folks all the time? We never saw this many black people ever. It worked like a charm, but it was a marketing endeavor concocted by the same people marketing Barack Obama. So now they have in their clutches, in the same way that, by the way, you know, it's a very interesting thing how these things work. They got black people during the 2008 election to literally spawn an industry. Black people were out there in the hot sun, knocking on door to door, bringing back all this intelligence, all this information. They knew all the details, house by house, street by street, block by blocks, city by city. They had information, a kind of information, a demographic breakdowns, the likes of which have never been seen in America, and they got it for free. Those people that they sent out there, you know, the souls that eventually went to the polls and got other people to go to the polls as well, they provided all of that for free. They brought it all back to the white minds controlling this whole operation, who now are multi-million-dollar consultants using the information that they got for free from the black people. But you know, this is life. You towed that barge and lived that bale, but you do all the brawn work and we do the brain work. And it has now given them the ability to establish a multi-million-dollar consulting practice right there in Washington, D.C. Same thing here. The souls to the polls concept worked so well that the Democratic Party actually got the benefit of a system that is unlike any other in the world of politics. You have, you bring in the pastors, and this is why Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton are out there, you know, running around making speeches, and don't you ever believe that they're doing this because of the goodness of their hearts. They're getting paid. They've already commodified the civil rights movement. It's worth money now. It's worth big money. All of the big civil rights people are now consultants and big money people. You know, you have to see how ironic it is that the civil rights leader, Jesse Jackson, has the Wall Street Initiative, whatever the heck that is. We know that it is essentially, Wall Street money. And Sharpton has the Madison Avenue Initiative. Madison Avenue, again, money. The advertising world is on Madison Avenue. Okay, so we have the souls to the polls. They've brought in all of these people who are now going to be ambassadors to a community in which they have extraordinary influence. They have the ability to influence people's votes. And they're ramping this up, but guess what? In order for this to work really well, it necessitates the entire black community essentially entering a time machine, traveling back to the civil rights era of the 60s, late 50s and 60s, and staying there. Souls to the Polls is not about proactive movement. It's not about what we can exact from the Democratic Party. It's not about flexing muscles. It's not about confronting the party of the Klan and the slavocracy South. It is about being a part of it, being participants in your own oppression. This Souls to the Polls isn't asking for anything. It is making no demands. It hasn't set up a barometer of expectations as to what it is that they would expect the Democratic Party to deliver. No. The aim and objective are the same. You do this, this is what you do. You go out and get people to flick the lever over there, and, you know, go to the voting booth and just press the X right there and get lost. When we need you again, 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, whatever, we'll call you. There are no demands. There is nobody sitting down saying, well, wait a minute. What's the deal with the fact that we have no new housing being built here? Why is it that you're shutting down our schools? How come we live as they do in Ferguson and in St. Louis, predominantly black towns, and we have an almost all-white political power structure? How do you explain that? We have no demands at all. You don't have any demands about employment, and your employment unemployment figures are staggering. You make no demands whatsoever. You just are supposed to have a sense of satisfaction that you have outperformed for a party that is oppressing you and your people. But, you know, the money's good. The money's good. So you will take that. And some of them don't even get money, but they get status. They get a kind of vicarious thrill that they're close to people who are making money. And if they do really good jobs at bringing souls to the polls, who knows, they may get an invitation to the White House. They really may get to go rent a tux. This is pimping. And it is about time that the the people of these churches say, look, this is a sacred space for us. A church is our home for, it serves a very important purpose to center us spiritually so that we could deal with the crap that we have to deal with every single day. We will not have the 1 hour of special time that we set aside on a Sunday interrupted by Joe Doakes and Mary Mokes coming to make speeches in our churches. We're not going to have that. These are people who ordinarily would not even set foot in our community, let alone our churches. You know, Malcolm X once said that 11 o'clock on Sunday is the most segregated hour in America. And he was right. Because all those souls that are being enticed to go to the polls, they go to their churches, which are in segregated communities that are fast eroding out of a conspiracy to disembowel them, to get them to move out, like Detroit. The whole city of Detroit is being systematically emptied. And guess what? Barack Obama's Souls to the Polls program is working quite well there. Yes. Tomorrow, Michelle Obama will appear in Detroit to kind of stump for the Democratic candidate for governor, I believe. Souls to the Polls. In a city where black people, the vast majority of them in the city of Detroit, their children are going to crappy schools if they have those schools to go to. Schools are being shut down. We heard a report on this program that in the last 2 years alone, the city of Detroit's schools have been shut down by half. Half of the schools have disappeared and closed in the last 2 years. In the city of Chicago, 300 plus schools. And it's happening all over the country. Souls to the polls, though. Bring those souls to the polls. You're voting and you have no jobs. Souls to the polls. You're voting and your children have crappy schools or no schools at all, no public schools at all, as in the city of New Orleans. There isn't a single public school left in the city of New Orleans. New Orleans is now totally given to the predatory interests of charter schools. Souls to the polls. But you're voting. You're voting. You're voting. You have no new housing built in your community, but you're voting. You have no control whatsoever over the economic engine that, such as it exists in your community, it still does not belong to you, but you're voting. You're voting and your communities are under blistering attack. They have already been designated to operate with you outside of them. You're not supposed to be there. And they're working hard at making sure that that happens, like in Detroit and in the other black cities in the state of Michigan, all of which are under emergency management and all of which are being systematically emptied. Because there's a whole new vision in America. You don't belong in it, but you should be voting. Souls to the polls. You're voting and your children are being shot down in the street by police officers who still are not arrested or let alone prosecuted. But you're voting. Souls to the polls. You're voting and most of the people in your community are hungry. The senior citizens are barely able to live from day to day. Food stamps are being cut. School lunch programs being cut. But you're voting. You're delivering for the Democrats. Souls to the polls. you're voting, and every single measure by which one can calibrate what the quality of life is, every single measure tells us that the same communities, these same souls that are showing up or being enticed to show up at the polls, are living in communities under conditions that nobody in their right minds would ever think are basically conducive to a good life. A life of stress? Yes. A life of deprivation? Yes. A life of inequality? Yes. But you're voting. Bring those souls to the polls. The person we last heard talking about souls to the polls, the offensive remark came from none other than Barack Obama himself. Speaking contemptuously, and they still haven't gotten the joke. He's insulting them and they're applauding. Speaking to the members of the Congressional Black Caucus at their annual pledge of allegiance to the Democratic Party that they call an annual conference, when they're supposed to be in pitched battle with this party, in which black people are so heavily invested as to what it is that they have done with the support that they've gotten. But of course, they're not in a position to do that because they too are part of the problem. These people who walked with Martin and who came out of the civil rights movement are now full-fledged partners in the oppression of their communities. Souls to the polls. The president is saying to these people assembled, representing distressed communities, and many of whom themselves are distressed. It's not like they're making a lot of money. They're making a lot of money compared to what they used to make, but in the scheme of things, they're not that rich. And he's telling them how well the stock market is doing. And they are applauding wildly, because their president is doing good for the neighborhood. Stocks are doing well, he says. And employment is up, as if they would know. Nobody has bothered to take a little survey and find out if, in fact, employment is up in black communities. Is employment really up? They're wildly applauding the man who is going to be sending their sons and daughters into harm's way on specious grounds with reckless decisions that has put the country at war. Oh, they applaud him. Souls to the polls. That's right. And if he were allowed to run for a third term, they would certainly do that. But you know, the Souls to the Polls movement is really clear about what its ultimate mission is. They know it. And it is now about Hillary's turn, laying the groundwork as they had for Barack Obama. So too will Souls to the Polls deliver for Sister Hillary. That's right. Sister Hillary is next. And there will be people falling all over themselves to be the first pastors in line to prove their troth to Sister Hillary. You know, I remembered when Hillary Clinton, who actually left the White House 2 years before her husband did, after that little problem that they had there, you know, that the Oval Office that he established right next to the Oval Office. Well, she left the White House 2 years before. And next thing you know, she's a senator. And who do you think did that? Souls to the polls. The black elected officials of New York City and New York State were falling over each other. They couldn't get out of each other's way fast enough to say, yes, Hillary, we want to give you a Senate seat. She didn't have to run for dog catcher or cat catcher within the Democratic Party. She didn't have to prove anything. She just had to be the woman who just left Bill in the White House and is now perfectly entitled to a U.S. Senate seat, and boom, there it is. It's done. And for the most part, it was Souls to the Polls that made Sister Hillary. So y'all are responsible. I'm holding you responsible for that. And they're cranking it up again. See, this is the contempt that they have, this party has, for the black vote. But it is more than that. It is the contempt that the black community itself has for its own vote. It does not value it. It just does not understand how it is to be used. And it trades it off so casually that it actually dishonors the history of people who did make tremendous sacrifices in order that this particular franchise be won. How are we to confront the situation? Are people in churches really ready to confront their pastors and ministers and say, wait a minute, what's this Souls to the Polls thing supposed to do? What are you asking for? What is it that we are expecting from the Democratic Party? And why is it always a one-way street? Why is it always about what we can give them when it actually should be, what are they giving us? What do we get? Which is the nature of politics. This is not something emotional. This is about, you know, cut and dried business. You want my vote? Great. What are you giving? These are my demands. Just check off on this long list I have here. What are you willing to do? There's no such discussion going on. We have these interlopers who have now professionalized the pimping of the black community and the most distressed people in the black community. They're now part of the industry of consultancies and you know, I am the middleman now. I'm the person that you have to see because black people are just so completely unable to articulate their own points of view that they need these messianic creatures to come in and speak for us. Still, we still hold to that. It's time to destroy that. That doesn't hold up. That's not important. That is not relevant anymore to what it is we're talking about. And to be very honest, they don't qualify, which is the ultimate thing. These people who are speaking for the black community, ministers with portfolio, are in no way qualified. They might have been in one way or the other at some point in time, but politics is, look, we looked at your record of performance and you don't measure up. You are now a liability. You are not a help to our situation. You got to go. I've spoken on this program about the need for people to publicly cancel the contracts of individuals who have aided and abetted the other side, who are working against the interests of the community. We should make that a very solemn event. You publicly call some kind of a news conference and very symbolically, you cancel their contracts. Say, listen, in case you think that person A or person B is representing our interests, we are here to let you know that we do not recognize them as our leaders. We do not recognize them as help to us. We recognize them as, in fact, enemies, traitors of our aggregate interests. And we hereby inform the public that you are dealing with somebody who does not have a license to transact business in our name. That's what needs to be done. But no, you are into taking your soul to the pole. That's right. You hearing the heavenly message, and you're living in hell. As Bob Marley's song says, you think you're in heaven, but you're living in hell. It is so true. Well, we have to look at all of these systems and ask ourselves, why is it that we continue to aid and abet their capacity and capability of literally doing us in? Why do we support systems that are contemptuous of our interests and needs? Why do we participate in our own oppression? Why are we unwilling to call these people out and to hold them publicly accountable for their actions, which are deleterious to the aggregate interests of our community? And they're not just black people. You know, Chuck Schumer, the senator from New York, is as lethal to black interests as Jesse Jackson is. Governor Cuomo is as lethal as his father was to black interests in the state of New York. These people have to be confronted. But more than anything, an educational process has to occur within the community about this business of the vote. And we have to see that connected to this, and this is the problem, the people who should be delivering these messages, the people who should be undertaking this educational process of saying, we have to see the thing for what it is. We have to see our situation for what it is. And we have to make it a point not to conspire to do our own selves in. We're not going to be part of this process. We reject it utterly and completely. And those are the people who are paid in one way or the other, whether in cash or in kind, they are paid to betray their constituencies and bring those souls to the polls, which is the only reason the Democratic Party has any use for the black community, especially. Latinos have done a remarkable thing. They sent a message just 2 weeks ago. Don't you ever take us for granted. We don't think that we will automatically go Democrat this year. Not over what you did with and are still doing over immigration. Fantastic message. Absolutely rattle them. Leave it. Leave them alone. Get them out. Get out of the party. Or make it so clear that it isn't about your dependency on the party. It's about the party's dependency on you. And that, my friends, is called power. You have a lot of power, but you're making it latent power, not actual power. The first thing you do is you get rid of the impediments to your power, which are the so-called leaders who are quite disingenuous and who are agents of your oppression. Get rid of them. Leave them. And secondly, deal with the party in very merciless terms. Do not spare any emotion here at all. Say, well, you know, we've had a long relationship. Oh, no, you're as good as what you did for me last. And the record isn't showing that you did a lot for me recently. So I got to leave you behind. I got to dump you. If you want me to support you, I'll know because you will make an effort and you will let me know that you are actively involved in my interests, in my prosperity, in my well-being, by the votes that you take, by the issues that you are supporting, by the interests that you support with us. If you don't do that, we have no use for you. Well, that brings me to the end of the program today. I hope it in some way causes us to ponder things a bit deeper. We'll know by tomorrow when it's Free Your Mind Friday. But in the meantime, Occupied Territory America is next with Mike Fader. Reach me at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. I hope this program was of some value to you today.
Things are getting better.